Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, 12/24/2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape.
Oh.
To tape.
To tape.
Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. We're on vacation. Finally, Emma released Matt, released Bradley, frolicking in anticipation of whatever it is you anticipate on Christmas. For me, it is solitude, peace and quiet, and usually like some type of woodworking project.
Right.
But I understand other people celebrate.
Well, I mean, I would say that Christmas used to be my favorite growing up, but Thanksgiving, you know, hits a little harder. Like, I think that now you gotta buy gifts, too, when you're an adult.
Yeah.
It hurts. It
comes a pain in the ass. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, well, financially.
You don't like your family.
Yeah, you know, no.
That's all right.
Well.
Now.
Not everybody.
So what we are doing right now is our best of shows for the next 6 days. The best shows of 2021 as voted by you, sort of. Today, what we are playing is a podcast that I did, we did back in March of 21. I don't think you were there. I think I pre-recorded this one. It was with Andreas Mom.
Mm-hmm.
And
the second half one, I was very much there for.
Yes. This is great. I did this interview with Andreas Mom. He is, he wrote a book, Learning to Fight in a World on Fire. And it is, He is a climate change activist who talks about property destruction as being maybe something that we need to contemplate, or people in the climate change movement need to contemplate as a way of changing the dynamics in terms of the way that fossil fuel investors assess the value of investing in fossil fuel. And apparently, subsequent to this, very recently, it became a big story that he was on the New Yorker. And in fact, like, I think the federal government started like spying on them or something, because he's an extremist. And so I just want to say welcome to, the FBI. Thanks for having us. Thanks for being here. And, there's more of this content, throughout the show. And, so you should check it out. One of the things I think if you're a federal agent, you're really going to enjoy is the second interview that we're providing today, which is Judy Gold. But not just Judy Gold alone. It is the opportunity that Judy Gold was looking for years. That is to confront Donald Trump, to actually ask him questions and yell at him and swear at him. And I don't think we ever told Judy, but it was actually James Austin Johnson, whose appearance on this show propelled him onto Saturday Night Live.
Well, that's how close we are with the NBC execs, right? Yeah.
Swimming in that Comcast money.
Yeah.
And Lauren loves the show.
And Lauren Michaels loves the show. And now, look, I don't know that that's exactly what happened, but sequentially, that's definitely what happened.
Mm.
So we have two great interviews for you. Andreas Mom, Learning to Fight in a World on Fire, and then Judy Gold with James Austin Johnson. From January of this year, of 2021.
Oh, really? Was that that long ago?
I know. Can you believe it?
I know.
It's a year ago.
That is, I mean, I've mentioned this before on the show, but you will watch me cry with laughter. That was as funny as a fun half has ever been, honestly.
I can't believe that was a year ago. Jesus.
And just to the actual title of the Mom book is How to Blow Up a Pipeline.
Oh, How to Blow Up a Pipeline. Sorry. How to Blow Up a Pipeline is the name of the book. Okay. Enjoy these two and check us out on Monday. Got Russ Feingold on the program.
Ooh.
On Monday. Check that out. All right. Enjoy this. And we'll see you on Monday. Folks, if you're looking for the perfect last-minute holiday gift, check this out. One of our sponsors is Shaker and Spoon. It is a monthly cocktail subscription box that delivers the ingredients and recipes for amazing craft cocktails, and it's right to your door. Now, look, I am a cocktail skeptic because I don't like sweet things. And
Me neither.
And I don't like those. But they sent us a thing. They sent a box. And I took the one for Mezcal. Bradley took the one for what? Rye? Okay. And so if you go right now to shakerandspoon.com/majority, they'll give you $20 off. This is what it does. Each monthly box comes with three different original cocktail recipes and enough ingredients for 12 cocktails, four from each recipe. So you get to, you know, you get to mix and you play around, but and a lot of the ingredients they send is stuff that's hard to find on your own. There was stuff that I'd never even heard of. Like this botanical sort of like spray that you did at the end.
I love mezcal, so that's very exciting for me.
This was really good, actually. And the sizes are small, so you can have a taste of something you haven't tried before instead of having to commit to a full bottle of something that you might end up only using once. It's good. This is the thing about it that I really like. It introduces you to flavor combinations and, I guess, ingredients. Like, you know, not just like... you know, like orange bitters or like this floral stuff that I had in the mezcal and the recipe cards. Like I say, I don't like sweet cocktails. So you're able to sort of like measure how much you're going to put in. Literally last night, I went over, and this is actually going to be big, I think, over the next couple of months because I ain't going to a bar. Yeah, unless like we get another like night where it's like 55 degrees, I'm not going inside to a bar.
Right.
And so I think, you know, within your pod of people, going and having a cocktail night is going to be fun. But the thing for me that I like about it is that I learned about, like, I don't like the botanical spray.
Okay.
But I like the other stuff. Like so I made it once with the spray. You just do it a couple of times. But I like the bitters and I like this, and it really actually made like a delicious cocktail. And then I was like, now I know if I go out and I see like this, this ingredient or that ingredient, I know like make it without that. It just adds a certain sophistication to it. So, Shaker Spoon is now giving Majority Report listeners $20 off your first box when you go to shakerandspoon.com/majority. Or you can just click the link in the description, that's shakerandspoon.com/majority, for $20 off your first box of delicious cocktails. Check it out. And they have different ones. They have mezcal, they have rye. I think there are other things that you can use that are based on a different liquor. But those are my two favorite, I got to say. Check it out. shakerandspoon.com/majority. Hey, folks. End of the year. My favorite sponsor of the year, really the past couple of years, Sunset Lake CBD.com. They are fans of the show. They've been longtime fans of the show. Their coupon code, left is best, for 20% off, Sunset Lake CBD.com. They have fudge. They have gummy bears. They have tinctures. They have smokables. They have pre-rolls. They have keef. They have coffee. They got salve and hand lotion. And all of their products, all of the highest of quality. You can check out third-party analysis of their CBD on their site at Sunset Lake CBD.
And there's a lot of junk you can get of CBD at like the store around the corner or whatever. This is not that.
No. It is the highest of quality, and they have a tremendous amount of integrity as a company. Mostly employee owned, $15 minimum wage. They have donated thousands of dollars to different things, including we did that that thing with them to give money to give directly over $20,000. But they also have given tens of thousands of dollars to food banks, to strike funds. These are a movement partner, folks. And here's the thing. A, we've got a ton of emails about people appreciating the product. And I know that they get a lot of repeat business. So you know their product is great. They're from outside of Burlington, a bunch of burners up there, Burlington, Vermont. Check it out. SunsetLakeZebedee.com. Left is best. One word, you get 20% off. Left is best. 20% off. All one word. Left is best. Joining me now from Sweden is Andreas Malm. He teaches human ecology at Lund University in Sweden. He is the author with Ashura S. Malian of Iran on the Brink, Rising Workers and Threats of War, and of Fossil Capital, which won the Isaac and Tamara Deutscher Memorial Prize. And his latest, How to Blow Up a Pipeline, Learning to Fight in a World on Fire. Andreas, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sam.
Let's start with, I want to dovetail into, we were just talking before we started here about our relative situations in terms of the pandemic. There's sort of a paradox with what's happening between climate change and the COVID pandemic. There's also implications for the movement to fight climate change. Just speak to that a little bit, and then we can talk about sort of your assessment of climate activism more broadly speaking.
Yeah, it feels like an eon ago, but in 2019, the climate movement was at its peak in terms of popular support and mobilization on the streets, in the global north at least. And then it just fell off a cliff when the pandemic broke out and suspended all activities. So Greta Thunberg, the key figure in this movement, announced that henceforth it will all be about the coronavirus, and we're not going to have those strikes and Friday marches any longer. We'll just go online. And climate was on the top of the political agenda, at least in Europe, for 2019. And then everything was just taken over by the coronavirus, and climate disappeared from the agenda. And that's, of course, extremely unfortunate. But we will inevitably face more climate disasters in the near future. And we have to hope that the movement regains its momentum and perhaps escalates and swells and radicalizes. That's at least my hope.
Yes. And we should say, excuse me, the interesting sort of paradox is that during this this past year, the amount of carbon that we're putting into the air has gone down, obviously, because economic activity and travel has gone down so dramatically. What do you think? And then we'll get to sort of a broader assessment of the climate fighting movement. What do you think the implications are of that?
Well, there are many implications. So emissions fell globally about 7% last year. And that was obviously not because of any deliberate mitigation of climate change, but it was an entirely unintentional side effect of measures put in place to combat the pandemic. Now, that shows that emissions reductions are in fact possible, even if they happened for other reasons. A cut by 7% per year is at the very high end of what people in the climate movement have demanded. So mostly we haven't called for that kind of abrupt cut in aviation and other forms of transportation that the combating of this pandemic implied. So I think that people will remember that it is in fact possible to close things down, and you can, as a state, go in and tell businesses that you will have to close now. We need to shut those shopping malls down and things like that. The difference, of course, will be that a transition from fossil fuels to renewable energy is forever, whereas the measures put in place to combat the pandemic were announced from the beginning as temporary ones that would soon revert back to business as usual. But still, what they did show, and what I think people will remember, is that states can, in fact, interfere with the operations of markets, and it's not technically impossible to close certain certain very destructive and harmful industries down. And I think that this will change the climate debate, I hope at least, after the pandemic, if there is a time after the pandemic, and people will recall that things are in fact possible.
I mean, there, you know, there has been, at least I think in this country, to a certain extent, I mean, part of it is a function of coming off of Trump, but there is I think that comes out of the pandemic, or could potentially come out of the pandemic, is a sense, and this is in for, you know, I guess we're now 40 some odd years into a period where the government is perceived to be the obstacle to things. There is a sense that as a collective, and that, you know, articulated through our government, we can actually do things that and change the course in some respects of nature, if you will, in the sense of the pandemic. And I think that's it's sort of a fascinating element that could come out of the pandemic. I mean, one of the things that, you know, certainly early on I heard this more too, is that what we were experiencing with the pandemic was similar to the dynamic of climate change, but sped up multiple times. And it really is. I mean, these are two things that, you know, you can say are impacting the world, right? And there's very few events that this actually takes place where everyone is in some fashion, theoretically, impacted by this. Let's speak to the challenge that's brought about, and maybe reflect it back upon how climate activism has operated, to the idea of, like, you know, the pandemic happens like this, and it is sped up. And because it's sped up, the implications we feel far more dramatically, broadly speaking, than we would with climate change. Right? I mean, climate change is sort of hard to sort of like really hold in your hand and look at, because it's happening so broadly, and, you know, except for to look at the science documented, it's happening. It doesn't feel like it's happening in that moment, right? In the way that, like, COVID does. I walk out, I've got to wear a mask, I could catch it tomorrow, and I'd be sick in a couple of days. Speak to that dilemma and how it's been addressed by climate activism up to this point.
Yeah, let me just say that I think there is a degree of an optic illusion, or maybe even an ideological distortion or misrecognition of what's going on in this way of framing the problem. And just the other day, I'm sure you read the news, there was a glacier that fell into a dam in northern India and set off an enormous avalanche of water and stones and sand and mud that just suddenly smashed through a village and killed 200 people. That is global warming hitting extremely fast and brutal and hard. And you see precisely the same sequence when a hurricane smashes into Louisiana, or there's a wildfire in Oregon or somewhere else in the Pacific West. These instances of climate impact are just as sudden and immediate as a pandemic. And a pandemic, in fact, a pandemic such as this one, COVID-19, is part of a trend where we have more and more infectious diseases jumping from wildlife into humanity. So I think the two trends, global warming and what you might call global sickening, they develop in tandem and in fairly similar fashion. And then you have those moments of immediate crisis, where what states do is that they combat the symptoms. They don't go after the drivers. And still, no states that I know of during this year have even made any attempt to address the drivers of pandemics, namely rampant deforestation, primarily in the tropics, and wildlife trading and other completely unsustainable encroachments on wildlife that create those diseases. And it's exactly the same thing with global heating. What states seem capable of doing is to evacuate certain citizens in harm's way when a hurricane is approaching, or sending firefighters into areas afflicted by wildfires. But what states do not seem capable of doing is to go after the drivers of global heating, and these are the sources of fossil fuel production and combustion, and close them down. That is the task of climate activists and the climate movement, to go into primarily fossil fuel production and try to shut things down, because that's what has to happen. Otherwise, we'll be doomed to ever escalating, ever increasing, ever deteriorating disasters like this.
And so let's talk about what climate activism has done to this point in terms of that agenda of closing down production. Where how do you see its successes and how do you see its failures in terms of doing that?
Well, to focus again on the global north, as you know, there have been struggles around pipelines in the US and in Canada, led primarily by indigenous peoples that have fought against the construction of those pipelines. There was an episode fairly recently in Canada where you had people closing down much of the transportation network and other parts of logistical infrastructure in Canada to oppose pipeline construction. In Europe, where I'm active, it looks a little bit different. We don't have the same situation with indigenous populations fighting fossil fuel infrastructure. But what we do have primarily in Germany, which is the powerhouse of the European economy and the responsible for most of the emissions, is a movement that has systematically targeted the lignite coal mines. That's the dirtiest fossil fuel of all. And what we've done is we've assembled something like 5,000-7,000 people and entered those mines and shut them down for 1 day or 2 days or something like that, to put pressure on the German state to actually close these mines down. Now, we've reached some distance with this, but certainly not far enough, because the current decision is that those mines will be closed by 2038. So that's another 2 decades of digging up the dirtiest fossil fuel. That's completely unacceptable. They should be closed now and replaced with renewable energy. So that's why this struggle will continue in Germany. And I think we've learned a lot about how to do this, how you can break through police cordons and enter this kind of mines and surrounding facilities and close the infrastructure down. And I think the climate camps doing mass actions like this should spread and proliferate everywhere in the global north where you have those kind of facilities and shut them down more extensively, more frequently, for a longer time.
But that's from a tactical perspective. Like, strategically speaking, like, what is the agenda for climate change activists? And that, I mean, from a strategic standpoint, if the tactic is to, you know, shut down a mine here or there, is it to create pressure on governments, or is it to undercut the ease in which profit is derived from these activities?
Very good question. And I think it's both. I think it should be a way of deterring investors from pouring more money into fossil fuel production. And here's where you have the possibility of property destruction, of trying to make clear to those investors that if you keep on investing in fossil fuels, you can't be sure that someone won't come and actually wreck your machinery and your equipment and destroy it, put it out of business. But at the end of the day, it will have to be governments that take the decisions to shut down fossil fuel production. No one else can do it. Activists can't make that kind of decision. What we can do is we can put pressure on the states. Just like the Black Lives Matter movement in the US put pressure on certain parts of the US state apparatus, on state level, perhaps primarily, to reform policing and concede various concessions to the movement. It would be the same thing with moves away from fossil fuels. That won't happen by states, by incumbent governments taking those initiatives of their own accord spontaneously. If it will ever happen, it will be in response to mass pressure from below, from outside the state apparatuses. That's what the past few decades of continued business as usual have taught us, I think.
I want to examine those two elements, and then I want to in a moment compare it to Black Lives Matter movement, which, like you say, we just saw, for instance, in Austin, Texas, they've cut, they've had a significant cut, you know, a fraction of their police budget, but a significant fraction that they have now using to, buy hotels and house the unhoused in Austin, Texas, just as an example. We see other examples, locally around the country, as at least, you know, initial steps. I mean, some indication that these massive protests that took place over the summer had an impact. I want to just disaggregate these two things because your book, obviously, How to Blow Up a Pipeline, it's not specifically a how-to on how to blow up a pipeline, but the idea is that from a tactical standpoint, there is, you're making an argument that some of these tactics may need to be expanded in terms of where the movement has been. This is a relatively controversial, perspective, but we'll examine it a little bit more. But so the strategy is ultimately to get the government to shut these down. Is the idea of diminishing, the profit of the fossil fuel industry, or to put at risk, to discourage investment in this, because it seems to me there's a couple of different ways that investment is discouraged. One is that we have amassed enough of a movement that public policy is going to change in 5 or 10 years. So your horizon to get your investment returns is very severely limited. And we're going to throw other obstacles into doing that. You expend a lot of money in a drilling rig. Well, if we shut that down 100 days out of the year, the returns on that investment are going to be diminished dramatically. What's the idea? Is it just these two things go in tandem? We want to diminish investment in these things and simultaneously push governments? Or is it that diminished investment in these things makes it easier to push governments?
And this is a very good way of posing the question. I think you're onto something very important, and I think that part of the bridge between the two perspectives, if you like, is that while potentially, I mean, we're talking about potential campaigns that haven't materialized yet, but if these sort of campaigns were to kick off for real, you would have a reduction of profits, and you would also put a real social stigma on these kind of investment activities. Just like use the analogy of BLM, that you established certain kind of, moral, the BLM surge that happened after George Floyd put a certain moral tarnish on policing in the US, or an ethical critique of police structures in the US. And I think it could potentially work in a similar fashion, that with massive campaigns against the most insane fossil fuel infrastructure expansion that's happening, you will shift the balance, tip the scales against that sort of expansion, and demonstrate that this is actually not acceptable. It can't go on like this. Just to take one example, Total, the largest private corporation in France, an oil and gas company, is planning to go into the Arctic to drill for even more gas with the support of Macron, the French president. And you know, everyone should at least know that this is just absolutely bizarre, that in 2021, with so much of the planet on fire and ice melting at a speed that tracks the worst case scenarios, you have a major oil and gas corporation wanting to go into the Arctic to get more of the stuff out of the ground, to burn even more. There should be a massive campaign against that in France. There isn't, but there should be. And it should include going after the installations, the facilities, the headquarters of Total, and make that into a burning political issue in that country. that would make it politically impossible in the end for the president to support this totally unacceptable project of expansion. So I just imagine that these two things could go hand in hand, trying to reduce profits and also putting pressure on the states to make the necessary decisions.
I want to explore this idea that that what you're talking about when we talk about diminishing the profits for fossil fuels is not a battle between, I think, as you write, it's not a question of efficiency versus idealism. This may come a little bit from Fossil Capital, your earlier work, but this idea that we have fossil fuel because it is such an efficient form of energy, both in terms of cost and whatnot. It's in fact not that it's necessarily more efficient particularly at this juncture, but that it's simply the thing that you can get the biggest markup on, that you can get the biggest profit from, as opposed to renewable energies. It's not that renewable energies are not efficient. I mean, like this dynamic, you know, I think people who know venture capital, they come across medicines or inventions that would be incredibly helpful to people, but there's just not a 10x or 100x return on these. And so they don't invest in them. That's the dynamic that we're talking about with these different types of energies. Is that right?
Exactly. And it's so paradoxical because now renewable energy is so cheap that it beats fossil fuels in most places in the world, and this holds even after the collapse in oil prices during the pandemic. So solar power in many parts of the globe produces the cheapest electricity that human beings have ever produced, and still you don't see the shift. And the paradox here is that the extreme cheapness, and the more extreme it becomes, the cheapness of renewable energy is a curse from an investment standpoint, precisely for the reason that you say, that you can't get the same profit, you don't get the same yield, the same gain from producing something as cheap as renewable energy is now becoming. So for the energy giants in the world, companies like Total or BP or ExxonMobil or Chevron, it's still massively more profitable to invest in fossil fuels than in renewable energy. So the transition, and it's extremely important to remember that investments in energy are not determined by price, but by profit. What's most profitable is what will attract investment money. So the transition away from fossil fuels to renewable energy will not happen by private corporations, or for that matter, state-owned profit-hunting corporations, shifting from unprofitable fossil fuels to profitable, cheap, renewable energy. The transition will happen by states ordering them to do so by some regulation or other, or even taking them over, nationalizing those corporations and implementing, executing the transition because it's what's needed for human beings and for the planet, not because it will create more profit. It might create cheaper electricity, but it won't create more profit because sun and the wind, they come naturally, spontaneously. You don't need to invest in a lot of labor and fixed capital to get it out of the ground as you do with oil and gas and coal. And there, then you can sell it as a commodity. The flow of sunlight and wind come naturally for free. That's why they're so fundamentally cheap and unprofitable. It's very paradoxical.
You get one bite at the apple. You build the panels, and then basically you don't have any way of getting any more profit. I mean, they sort of figured out the opposite with with printers, right? Like we can build a sort of a junky printer. We're not going to make our money there, but if we can sell the ink each time, then we're going to make our money through the ink. So this question of, so if the issue is to cut down on profit, one of the things that you suggest is that activists, because of the dire need that's going on here, increase essentially the arrows in their quiver. And you're not suggesting that everyone should take this tack, but you're not talking about violence towards people or anything like that. It is the idea of how do you make the investment class the wealthiest people in the world, essentially, nervous about their returns by investing in the apparatus that are going to do this. And one of those ways is you show that maybe public opinion's turning against them and governments could have new policies. And the other is to literally, like, take some of this stuff offline. What do you say to people who say, like, look, that type of direct action that you're talking about has never worked. And, you know, we have Gandhi, we have MLK, we have the suffragettes, we have, you know, anti-apartheid movement. That we've shown time and time again that when you are civilly disobedient, that's far more effective than any type of direct action that you're talking about.
Yeah, so, I mean, here we could talk for hours or even days, but I spend some time in my book on debunking this narrative of history as fundamentally sanitized and dishonest in its treatment of those actual events. So the struggle for independence in India contained a lot of violence and property destruction. So did the suffragette movement for women's right to vote. So did, of course, the civil rights movement in its various manifestations, and not to mention the anti-apartheid struggle, of course, in South Africa, which had its own, the ANC ran an armed campaign. And in every instance that strategic pacifists adduce in support of their thesis that the most successful struggles have been completely nonviolent, in fact, if you just scratch the surface, you will find a lot of property destruction and confrontation with the police and other aspects of the ruling order and things like that. So, as historical science, that thesis is extremely weak and extremely poor. It's just not correct.
Well, what you're talking about, let's talk about what you call the radical flank effect. What does that mean, and how does that operate?
Yeah, so that term comes from sociological research into the civil rights movement in the U.S. And the argument the researchers have made is that MLK became palatable, or at least viewed as the least bad alternative in the eyes of the American state, when there was a radical flank to the left of MLK, so to speak, that was made up by rioters from Birmingham and onwards in the ghettos around the country, and by Malcolm X and the Nation of Islam, and then the Black Panthers and those parts of the Black movement that said we're going to fight by any means necessary. And because that was a real threat, the state realized that unless we make concessions, serious concessions, to the mainstream of the civil rights movement, we're going to end up with these guys who in our eyes are much more terrible. So because of the existence of a radical flank, the civil rights mainstream achieved its demands. That's the argument.
We can
now, of course, things are more complicated than that, but you can also find a radical flank effect of a similar kind in hundreds of instances in modern history where, I mean, in Europe, the demands for the 8-hour working day or, democratic elections with the right to vote for everyone, these demands were achieved under the threat of the Bolshevik Revolution and it spread into Europe. So as an historical phenomenon, I think the radical flank effect clearly exists. And I would say that, it existed in the Black Lives Matter movement last year as well.
So with just about a minute left here, I mean, from the perspective of, you know, we have people who are more comfortable, not as urgent about these dynamics, call them the white middle class in the context of this country. What is the recommendation from your perspective in terms of like how they should perceive that radical flank? How should that relationship be managed?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I mean, when you frame it this way, the task of the radical flank is to shake things up and to make clear that unless we change the way we do things, there is a risk that the whole order will be overturned. So it's partly about scaring the ruling class into mending its ways and making serious concessions, because otherwise you will end up with a lot of trouble. That's how the radical flank works in the US in the 60s and 70s, and that's, I think, what the climate movement needs now. We need a radical flank to the left of Greta Thunberg and Extinction Rebellion and what has existed so far that says that, I mean, look, things are now so grave, so serious, that we can't accept this business as usual anymore. We're going to start putting it apart physically. The way to avoid this scenario is to concede to all the demands made by the more mainstream current of the movement. And then we can start talking business, doing business. I mean, that's when things really start to happen.
Andreas Baum, the book is How to Blow Up a Pipeline, Learning to Fight in a World on Fire. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam. Thank you.
And for those of you who are sticking around, Judy Gold will be joining us any moment. Well, we're not going to go into the fun. In fact, yes, here she is. Yeah, Brendan, we didn't hear that music during that break. And here is Judy Gold. She looks like the book, Yes, I Can Say That, which is her new book. Judy, are you there? Is she coming on?
I'm here.
Hey, Judy.
Judy Gold.
Wait,
so hold on for a second. We need some music. Can we play some music? We need to play Judy Gold's theme song.
We just had trouble with the break music. We may not be able to... Oh.
Headed,
fuck you!
Calm, cool, and collected.
I have a bigger penis than him.
Judy Gold is on the line to keep us all connected.
What the fuck is the matter with him?
A steady hand to guide us. She'll keep us calm and carry on.
No fucking way!
Too bad Jimmy Reefer Cuck didn't find her worthy of a song. Well, Judy Gold.
And he's such a fucking penis head liar. I'm not kidding. That's the president of the United States. That's the president.
I am the only thing I could think of is, like, at one point we're going to bring you on, and I just can't help but think maybe there's a chance it's just going to apply to our next president too on some level.
Not right now, Sam. No. Not right now.
Judy, you must be. Have you met? You've met Emma, right? You know,
yes,
Emma.
Yes, I love Emma.
Love you too, Judy.
You must be ecstatic right now.
You know, it's funny. I have a myriad. That's my hair of feelings. But, like, you know, the rage. You know, they say that rage is buried sadness, and I realize that. I cried so much on Wednesday that I was very sad about what was happening to our country. Like, there was, and that the only way I know how to deal with that is by screaming and yelling, because that's how I grew up. But yeah, I was really sad. That insurrection sent me over the edge. And
wait, what?
Yeah, you
what
know what I'm
you,
saying.
Well, I mean,
yeah.
Come on, like, let's be honest. I mean, you've been over the edge. I feel like for
all right, almost, I'm like, over the edge. Okay, so at least I'm in touch with my anger. and still, you know, like, sometimes I still get on there to look at, like, you know, what's his name, Junior and Kaylee, and I'm like, oh, I hate you, like my. I don't even think anymore when I write, when I tweet back. It's just like, shut up. Am I allowed to curse on this?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. I'm like, shut up, you fuck face. Fuck you, you fucking liar. Like, I just, get away, go, bye. But, you know, there were 74 fucking million people.
Judy, how did you feel at the inauguration? Because, you know, Sam and I were talking about it. I had a bit of an empty feeling. I kind of wish Trump had his Twitter account for like 12 more hours so we could melt down.
Yeah, I agree. There was a bit of like, can you just do a split screen of what they're doing right now so I can see what the hell's going on?
Did you see those pictures of the Trump kids crying, like Ivanka?
Oh my God. Fuck them. Like Ivanka has a feeling. You know, someone put like Visine at the end of her eye. I hate them. I hate them so much. They are so disgusting. Bye now. Bye-bye. The thing, though, when Biden's family came in, and it was just like normal people. It was normal people. Like Doug Emhoff is like a normal, nerdy Jewish guy. Like it was just, they're normal. I mean, you don't have to believe in everything that they say and do right now. Can we just have a honeymoon period, please? I can't take anymore.
You want?
I can grant you that honeymoon period.
Yeah, I mean, this is like, the thing.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Just for a couple of days.
That's all I got to say.
Whatever.
Well, this is my big lament is that, liberals, a lot of Democrats, the bad man's out of the office, we went through this with Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush. We went through this with G.W. Bush, bad man out of office, then go to sleep. But you know what? Mitch McConnell's still there.
I know that fuckface.
The Republicans are still there. The Democrats, you know, they have a job to do. We got to stay engaged. Yeah, brunch. There's no time for brunch.
You know, the one thing that fat orange fucking piece of fucking dirt and scum did was it made people more engaged in civics, in understanding, like, wait, he did what? He's not allowed to do that. I mean, people really, they know what the 14th Amendment is. They know what the second, the 19th, people know more about the government because he was such a fucking dumb piece of shit. So I feel like that was a positive thing. Like even my kids are really engaged in this. But that fucking McConnell, did you see, during the inauguration, they kept putting the camera on his face and they put the camera on Pence's face. I don't want to look at fucking Pence, but you're right. They're still there. Ted Cruz is still fucking. Did you see Ted Cruz's mask?
No,
I did not. What did it say?
It said you're not going to take this away from me. And it was a weapon. He's such a fucking asshole. His beard is shit. He's a fucking disgust. He's so ugly. And I hate him. He's my new fucking. I hate him so much.
The worst part about his like stupid gun is that it's performative. Like that guy's
right.
Princeton educated little weasel. He doesn't really want to go in a shooting range in his spare time. That's just his game.
Wait, what about these See You Next Tuesdays who are like one that wants to bring Lauren has to bring her gun on the house floor? What is that?
Lauren Boebert. Yeah, I don't know what the status of the investigation, but there's been, you know, some pretty serious accusations that she was basically giving people a tour around.
Yeah.
And she's got it coming. Now, listen.
And they had a map. She made a map. Yeah, she had a little map, like you get on a hike when you go on a hike, and they're like, "This, you know, this is this." So she had the little map. But here's what I don't understand. I can't get a fucking bottle of water through the TSA. Okay, I have a water bottle with half filled, and they're like, "You gotta blow it out. You can't go to get on your flight." And these fuckers can get in the Capitol building with weapons, and they're taking shits. They were defecating in these offices. How do you defecate on cue? Seriously, what were they like? You know, we're going to get in at 1:30. I'm going to have a bran muffin at 11:15 and a black coffee. All right.
I mean, them to do it in front of an audience, like that's got to be some sort of sign of sociopathy, right?
Oh my God. And you know, they're the same people who are like, don't want to share a bathroom with a trans person, but they'll take a shit on Nancy Pelosi's desk in front of everyone.
I feel like Gigi Allen did that once or twice too back in the day, but I'm not 100% sure about that. But But yes, it certainly, I think it's a weird thing to do. Like, hey, I got to go to the bathroom. So can we speed up this insurrection so we can get inside?
Yeah, I got to get in. I'm holding it in. It's coming out, guys. We got to get in.
Now, listen, Judy, I knew. I hope you're not mad about this.
What?
I knew how much you wanted to get a sense of what Donald Trump was doing in Mar-a-Lago. Now, I imagine Melania is like, I would be shocked if she wasn't in a different wing of the golf club. And they're just saying like, remember 30 days or whatever it is,
right,
and then you can go free. I knew that you were interested maybe in just getting a sense of how Donald Trump is taking it. And so, we got a call. Apparently we were the only ones who would accept it, but,
wow. Are you kidding?
Is he here?
Hello, Brandon. How are you doing this morning? It's so great to be speaking to you.
I'm not Brandon. I'm Sam.
Sam, you do such a wonderful job with liberal and with all of it. I think you do a really wonderful, wonderful thing. And I just want to compliment the Mondrian in the background. I think it's a beautiful. He was one
okay.
Of the
it's players. Definitely not him because he would not know what the fuck, but who Mondrian was. So we're done. Definitely an impersonator.
You know what? The Mondrian is one of Disney Plus's best, I think, one of the better Star Wars. I mean, not a lot of people like Rise of Skywalker. But they love Mondrian. They thought he was really good. They love it. They love when they do a big cowboy on the Star Wars. I just love to watch it.
Wow. So, Donald, can I ask Donald questions?
Please.
Listen, you fucking fat piece of shit. What's going on? Like, did Melania leave?
Okay, excuse me. Melania is fine. Everybody always asks the same thing. You know, what does Melania do? Is Melania happy?
I hate her, too. She's a bitch. You know, both of you are fucking assholes.
I'm not a huge fan either, but listen, life goes on, okay? It is time to unite and to come together.
Oh, shut up.
We need to, okay. Listen, you had your day. You had your day to scream. You got your guy now. I don't know what you're so upset about. You got your guy. He's a socialist. He's a loser. He's a big fat idiot, too. I mean, you've got your own.
Yeah, he's really a socialist. He really is. Listen, fuckhead. What's with Barron? I didn't see Barron at the fake goodbye shit that you pulled.
Everybody asks about Barron. You know, where's Barron? This is a boy with his own life, okay? He's got... do you have teenagers? Have you ever tried to get...
Yeah, I have one teenager, one 24. Yeah, uh-huh.
I told him, excuse me, Barron, I'm president. You know, we're going away now. We're moving out. And he says, 2 more minutes for Minecraft. 2 more minutes... just let me keep iPad. And I said, no, we've got to stop. It's time to get out of the grocery cart.
Are those the only words you spoke to him in the last 4 years?
I speak to him all the time, but he's got, it's called AirPods. And the kids love them. And he's always losing them. And I'm screaming into the ear with the AirPod. And he says he can't hear me. I go to the other ear. He says, well, I can't hear out of that either. Because you know what? These kids don't want to listen, and neither do Democrats. Neither do Democrats. They don't want to listen. They don't want to work together for a shared goal. It is all about
that's so true.
And
that's so
5 minutes on Minecraft and doing iPad and all of this.
Right.
So they're babies. I think they're being babies right now, frankly. And now they've got King Baby. They've got Boss Baby.
Yeah.
They've got their little
listen, what's going on with Rudy?
Rudy is, you know what, Rudy? What we're going to have to see. We're talking to Rudy very strongly. And we're going to have to see.
What's with your sinuses? What the fuck is going on? We're talking to Rudy. What is going on? Like, honestly, what do you do? Do you do the Adderall? What the fuck is going on there?
Okay, so it was called 1980s, okay? And nobody from 1980s has clear sinuses. I don't know. Maybe it was something in the air. There was a mysterious ash that infected us all and made us very peppy. And I just don't have access to those, whatever you call it. I don't know what they call it. You know,
they're called tissues, asshole. So what's going on? So you and Rudy he is such a fucking disaster. I mean, you're a disaster and you're a dumb fuck. But he is beyond, like, the shit coming out of his face And then sticking his hand down his pants. Like
okay,
he's.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Okay. Excuse me. Listen, everybody says that we're, I mean, nobody likes me. Okay. Nobody likes me. Nobody likes Rudy. But we have more support than anyone's ever had, frankly, anyone's ever had for a presidency, for a lawyer. So, and everybody hates us. I mean, I've never seen so much lack of support for two people that we've ever seen in our lives. But we have such an incredible base of people who support us and love us. It's really unlike any president you've
what
ever
do you,
seen.
Everybody what do you think the IQ of your average supporter would be, the IQ?
You know what, with Q, a lot of people like Q and they were listening and they're really upset now. They don't have their – they feel like they don't have the leaders anymore. And it's really a shame because
right.
Q, this is somebody who would wear the big Flintstones hat and he'd say, follow me. We're going to – where we go one, we go together and we do it all the time.
So
now they don't have Q.
All right, shut the fuck up. Listen, who do you hate more, Donald Jr. or Eric?
Eric. You know, with Don Jr., this is someone who is there for you. He's ready to work.
Right.
And he's a complete idiot. He's a total piece of shit. But
right.
when the chips are down, he is ready to get dirty and, you know,
take
what it
about,
where his son doesn't shine.
What about
Eric,
Tiffany?
You can't count on Eric. You just can't count on Eric. He's
well, he's a fucking idiot.
The clouds.
Listen.
He's off in the clouds.
Tiffany is marrying someone from a shithole country. Are you, what do you, how do you feel about that?
Tiffany. 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 What are you talking about?
Oh, okay. Just
listen, we're here to talk about issues. We're here to talk about real things. I'm not here to weigh in on the new Saved by the Bell or whatever the hell you're trying to push.
Right, right.
Because listen, I got Peacock and I wasn't a fan. You know what? There's too many subscription options. What happened to one option?
Right.
Okay. I want a $9.99 or I want to bundle with, I don't know, Hulu, Spotify, I don't know what else, whatever the hell you want to bundle it with. But I got on the Peacock and I said, I want to watch Office. Okay. And they said, well, do you want to watch it in Spanish? It's $2.99. You want to watch it, you know what, backwards? What the hell? That's $30 for some reason. So it's awful. I don't like Peacock and I don't like YouTube. I don't, whatever the hell you
okay.
Play
so listen, I really need to, I have another question, fuckhead. Listen. Like you're off Twitter. Like, what are you doing
respect
with all your
office. Respect yeah. the office? Okay, first of all, we have to come together and respect office. Okay,
yeah, because you
because
did such a good job of that. Yeah,
we so need to respect the office because Michael Scott might be that might be the funniest character that we've had on TV probably since I'm going to say probably since Marty Fife.
Marty Fife. Okay, listen. What are you doing? Like, there's no Twitter. What's your outlet? What are you doing now with all your dumb, stupid, nasty shit?
Well,
thoughts?
You know what? I like to queue up a couple autoplays of Bon Appetit and see what's in the pantry.
Mm-hmm.
And we just start throwing things together. Well, we were also talking about maybe arranging for a cross-country trip with Guy Fieri to, you know, see some of the, because there's a lot of restaurants. That you don't, you can't always go to Chili's. Sometimes it's nice to dry mom and pop. So I thought I might go with Guy. You know what? Maybe we're going to do a Guy. We're going to check out different restaurants or something like that. Because there's lots of places in this great nation that people maybe don't know so much about.
How much do you weigh?
You know what? That's not really something that we need to be, because in many ways I weigh a lot, but in other ways I'm one of the skinniest people that you've ever seen. So we feel very strongly when we're stepping on scale that it's a very good number, probably a better number than you've ever seen. I mean,
like 666
numbers.
Yeah.
You know what? Everybody always says this is devil, this is bad. I think the other guys were much worse in terms of Republican. I think I did a pretty good job of just kind of not doing the job. Do
yeah,
you really
I'm going to say that is true. That is the truest statement ever.
Excuse me, Karen.
Oh, I'm so sorry. You know what? You're not president. I can fucking interrupt you, ass.
Karen, do you
listen.
Want a guy in charge who's good at the job and disagrees with you? I don't think that you do. I don't think that you do.
Listen, Donnie, you know, Melania put in the fucking tennis court. How many times did you play tennis? Because I know you're very athletic.
I love to play tennis, and I love to do sport, and I love to do soccer, okay?
Soccer?
I like to do boxing. Sometimes I will punch straight through a wall because I heard that an obscure New York socialite said something pissy about me. I will just punch straight through a wall. Billy Blinks, you know what? I love to work out. I love to exercise. And I love to be active, okay? I'm probably one of the healthiest presidents you've ever seen. Frankly, of all of the current presidents, I would have to say I am the healthiest.
Yeah.
Right? Youngest, most beautiful.
Did you get the vaccine?
You know what? I don't think I need to do vaccine because I've already done disease. When you have the vaccine, that's for someone who doesn't have the disease because they want the disease. Do you know what a vaccine is, by the way? Little disease. It's Latin for little disease. So we didn't have to get the vaccine because we already did disease pretty big. I don't know if you saw, but we did a very good job with getting coronavirus. And it became disease really bad because you know there's a difference, right? There's corona. And then there's the virus, and then there's the disease.
Mm-hmm.
So it's separate things. With the injection, you're just getting the disease. You're not getting coronavirus. I think it's much better to get virus and let it see where it goes, okay? You don't get married on the first date. You see where it goes.
Right.
You see where it goes.
I have one final question.
Let Brandon talk. I mean, this guy wants to talk. I mean, am I talking?
No, he doesn't want to talk. He wants me to listen. You can talk to Sam. It's not Brandon. It's Sam. Listen, I want to know. I mean, you got three Supreme Court justices on the you know, confirmed. My final question is, how many abortions have you paid for in your life? Go ahead.
You know what? There's a time and a place for questions like that. And this is, by the way, okay, so you're feminist, right? So you know what we're talking about. We're feminist and we're women and hands off and all of it. So that is for a woman to know and talk about and her own story to share. And it's her own money to spend. That's ultimately what it comes down to. Okay, bottom line, this is a woman's problem. I don't think men should be talking about it, paying for it, whatever. You know what? This is for women to deal with. So in terms of have I paid for it? What did I pay for? Did I do it? I paid for everything else. Why should the woman have to pay for the dinner? So why should the man have to pay for abortion? These are traditional American values, traditional values.
Right. Well, I hate you. I hate you.
Judy, I have to say that it has been my fantasy to have the opportunity to for you to talk to Donald Trump. After he lost. And so
yeah.
I feel
you're a
like,
loser. Loser, Donald. You know loser. You fucking lost. Everyone hates you, fat fuck.
Excuse me. And yes, we lost, but in many ways we won probably bigger than anyone's ever
won. No, you
before.
Didn't. You didn't. You're orange. You're fucking ugly. You're fake. Your hair is fake. You're disgusting looking. You're disgusting.
You know when you say that? When you say that, you are, excuse me. When you say that, you are disenfranchising so many people. 70 million people. Okay, that's a lot of people. You're going to have to get along, okay? Either we're going to get along or we're going to start shooting each other's heads off.
I don't have a gun, fuckhead.
Well,
you should
can I just
like
step in here?
Yeah, sorry. I'm sorry, Sam. I should have ended on the abortion question. Gotcha. Yeah.
Judy, I know you got to jump, but this was...
I can't tell you how much I love this, Sam. This was Emma...
I knew it would be cathartic for you.
I'd like to do it again. I mean, if you can bring on, like, I'd love to have Ted Cruz on or Josh Hawley. But Donald, listen, I hope you continue to lose at golf. Everyone at all your neighbors around Mar-a-Lago hate your fucking guts. You ruined this country. You suck. And I hate your kids. So have a great weekend.
There's no pleasing these people, Brandon. There's just no pleasing these people.
No, I understand. All right, well, Judy, thank you so much.
Oh, my God. Thank you, guys. Great weekend.
All right.
You too.
There you go. I knew that would be incredibly cathartic for her.
She needs to chill out. She needs to get, you know, nice TV or something and just chill. Would it kill her to just, I don't know, watch one of those shows where they walk in a house and they say, I don't like the paint, you know, and they go with the other house or whatever that is, you know, whatever you calm down to.
You watch a lot of that TV? House Hunters, I think you're talking about.
I like it. It was a beautiful movie. How the young woman, she walked in. She said, I don't like the bank. The real estate agent says, well, maybe you could change the page. She says, no, let's go to a different house. Let's go to a different house and look at the different house.
It was not a movie.
Screaming at the movie. You can just paint over the paint, young woman. You can just paint over the paint.
That was not, that's a TV show. It's not a movie. That's why it was only 30 minutes long.
Well, you know what? I'm a very busy man, Brandon. Don't have time to watch every piece of every movie.
You've confused me the producer. Let me say goodbye to the president. I want to bring on our next guest. His name is James Austin Johnson. You may have caught some of his work on, I guess it's on YouTube or on Twitter.
Mostly Twitter and Instagram. It's mostly Twitter and Instagram. Yeah.
James, it's such a pleasure to have you here. I cannot thank you enough for allowing us to have that moment of therapy for Judy Gold. She has been.
That was incredible. I haven't laughed that hard in like.
Honestly, I think we just added like 3 years to her life with the stress relief that you provided. So, dude, it's a real pleasure to have you here. I don't know. I guess people stumble onto the fact they can do. Did you know you could do Donald Trump impression before he became president?
You know what? No, I probably started in 2015 or 2016. And I think I had the same reaction that everyone did immediately as comedians started doing Donald Trump, which is like, that's the most hack impression you could ever do. Why would I work on a Christopher Walken or a Michael McDonald? You know, why would I do Donald Trump? It's hack. But in general, just like as a comedian, I've always done impressions probably longer than I've done stand-up, but I wanted to be taken seriously as a stand-up. So I just never really pushed it on the impressions thing. And it's just hearing that voice every day for hours, for years, I couldn't help but attempt it. You know what? And if Sam Elliott was president, it would be Sam Elliott right now.
I mean, the touch of excuse me is like the thing that gets me, because that is just such a specific part of
batter
speech.
Yeah, you're so right. I mean, nothing pisses him off more than like a strong woman trying to like bulldoze him. And he does this like, calm down thing that I don't know what it is, but his tactics for controlling anybody and dominating anybody are kind of the exact same. But it seems like, especially with any time a great journalist who's a woman like attacks him, he does this like, hey, mamacita, please. Hey, okay, listen, excuse me. I love that little, I like when he goes down. I normally keep it at rally Trump. A pretty, you know, high wavelengths, lots of screaming. But when he gets calm and Luther Vandross and sexy, I mean, that's fun too. I love those tones too.
Oh yeah, it's sexy as hell.
Super sexy guy.
Yeah,
just oozes.
Lots of oozing. Yeah.
So James, where are you from?
I'm from Nashville, Tennessee, and Oklahoma City. And I'm now based in Los Angeles. I've been in Los Angeles since about 2011. And my wife and I go back and forth from Nashville to Tennessee pretty frequently, from Nashville to Los Angeles pretty frequently. So it's been an interesting time to have a foot in both a Republican stronghold and a, you know, hippie granola crunchy socialist prison, as Tennesseans think of Los Angeles. And I'm like, you should come hang out in Orange County. You'd like it a lot.
Do you feel oppressed when you're out there and then free when you get back to Nashville?
Quite the opposite. What I like about Los Angeles is the freedom to be a freak. Like if I want to walk down a street in Los Angeles and record myself as Donald Trump screaming about like Taika Waititi, I can. And there's always somebody freakier and weirder doing something much louder and stranger nearby to distract anybody normal who would think that's weird. But we were just in Tennessee for a couple months with our families. The stares that I get for doing anything out of the norm is so in these places that are like very libertarian and Republican and individualistic, you absolutely must conform to a normal way of living and dressing. There's they talk a really big game about individualism, but if you do something cool and fun and unique, man, that is hated and quashed by the social infrastructure as quickly as possible.
Did you do stand up? Were you doing stand up in Tennessee? Like over the, I'm obviously not in the past. I hope not so much. You've been laying off it for the past couple of months, but prior to, COVID, were you doing stand up there? Do you get political at all? Were you doing your, I mean, what I'm curious.
Yeah, I mean,
what
you're, in the before times, I definitely was doing, I would go back to like clubs in the South and stuff every once in a while. And, I mean, you can't just do hip alt rooms, and coffee shops and stuff. You have to do every kind of venue or you're not, you know, doing your duty. But, yeah, I would go back. I would do Trump stuff. I try to be as pretty goofy and just general comedy as possible in my act. But the last like few years, especially growing up super Christian, super conservative, I had to start confronting some of these, you know, these sort of these movements and these things in our times. And so I broach those subjects and some stuff really works. It's fun to see something that connects with a crowd that you weren't with a Baptist crowd that you weren't expecting to connect with. And then some of the stuff really, really does not, but you just got to plunge ahead. I mean,
wait, is it the case that you started on like the Christian comedy circuit?
Yeah, well, it's not so much a circuit as just whatever stage is available and whatever mic is hot. But yeah, I was a teen Christian stand-up comedian from like 14 to 18. I probably performed maybe 15 or 20 times total.
But what does that mean? So you would do, I don't know, I guess like
churches, block parties, Christian colleges. I did a riverboat one time.
Was your comedy? Yeah. Was your comedy at that time? I mean, I don't know. Maybe it still is. Are you telling Christian-y specific jokes or is it just like you were clean? Like, it wasn't like you were going to like a plumber's convention. You were like, hey, can you believe the new soldering stuff they have these days?
No, it's definitely in that clean zone. I mean, those are a lot of the comics that I grew up on were like, conservative-ish, Christian-ish branded comedians, but
like
my first love is this guy, and it's so strange because he's really changed as a lot of the guys of that generation have changed over the course of the last 20 years or so. I was really into Brad Stein. That was probably the first comedian I was really into. He's got albums like Wussification, A Conservative Unleashed, Rebel Without a Curse. I was asked this question all the time. I heard the men around me asking the same question all the time as I was growing up. Why aren't there more Christian comedians? Oh, I heard Jeff Foxworthy converted to Christianity. That's cool. Hopefully he cleans up his act. At some point, I heard that comment morph into why aren't there more conservative comedians? So even in Christian settings, they are not caring so much about getting Christian values affirmed as they are conservative values.
Is that what you meant when you said that they've changed? That these like sort of like 100%. People who were playing to Christian audiences
kept politics out of it.
Pete Holmes? Are you familiar with Pete Holmes' stuff? I watched that show Crashing a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah, Pete Holmes is that's an interesting guy. Definitely when I was sort of getting out of church world, his podcast talked a lot about those themes about like extracting yourself from conservative spaces like that. And that was very, very helpful at the time.
I need to introduce Sam. I just want to say real quick, I need to introduce Sam to Brad Stein, actually, because I think, Sam, you'll get a kick out of this guy. Because it is a lot of just right-wing comedy.
It used to just be a club comic, and then now it's all like the pussification of America and like all of these themes that are just like made up, the war on Christmas, stuff that exists only in, only virtually, only in the minds of people for many years. I only heard this in hushed tones at dinner conversations. Social media is where all of this codified and turned into like, you know, an actual movement of people. It's very strange. Like even Brad Stein performs a lot at these Promise Keepers conventions. If you're familiar, this is hotter in the 90s. But Promise Keepers is kind of a big group of dads who get together and promise not to masturbate. And he would perform at these men's empowerment conventions. And even that masculinity movement has really shifted to see how all of that has incorporated bodybuilding and QAnon and like conspiracy theories and, you know, all of those like fringe things are coming together when they used to seriously just be these conventions of guys getting together and being like, your wedding ring means a promise. It means that you love your wife. Like they were just affirming general normative good stuff. And now it's this like anti-gay sort of like militant thing. I really do not recognize a lot of the Christian subcultures that I came up in. It feels really weird. I do a lot of material about how it feels really weird to interact in those Jesus spaces these days. A lot of people feel alienated from them. And everyone of my generation that came up in that world is like, can I still go to church? I don't agree with any of these people anymore, like on anything.
That's fascinating. I mean, I think like my sense is that the comedy world, just broadly speaking, has become more political. And I guess I've been more conscious of it, you know, in terms of like the left where comedians are actively engaged in politics. It was not the case 15, 16 years ago, you know, when Janine and I started to do Air America, like our comedian friends who were all, you know, the lefties were still like, what are you doing? you know, like, why would you do this? And, you know, the idea of doing comedy and mixing politics, it's like, you can't. You know, you need to service the comedy only as opposed to any of the politics. And it hadn't occurred to me that that was happening on the right, particularly with Christian comedy. I mean, to be honest with you, I was not up on Christian comedy when it was, I guess, in its heyday.
How dare you?
But
how dare you not be familiar with
that's
a
fascinating
channel deep in the Sirius XM bank?
I have a lot of you like in terms of like people who grew up in that like evangelical. Were you evangelical?
See, stuff like born again and evangelical, we never used any words like that. I wouldn't even know if we were. When I think of the word evangelical, I think of Baptists. I grew up in what's called the Church of the Nazarene, which is very different from Baptists. There are so many theological things to parse and separate yourself from other churches when you're in Christianity in deep with it. And so, you know what, I never felt like I belonged to the world of the like overly made up and Botoxed people hawking magic water on TBN. That never felt like our world ever. You know what I mean? Like we weren't super involved with, you know, running up and down the aisles. Actually, the church that I grew up in was very anti, you know, tongues and doing cartwheels and stuff. So you can, once you get into it, you know what I mean? It's like rock and roll. Emo is very different from alt country. basically they're the same thing, you know, four instruments and a drum set or whatever. But it gets very, very different when you're actually in that world. It's the best way I can sum it up.
And it was your family were Republican and conservative. I mean, so that was sort of
but you didn't talk about it. It was like a thing you assumed. It was a private thing that you did every 4 years. You didn't talk about it. You know, like the analogy about sex. It wasn't a thing that anyone acknowledged. Has been very interesting to see the lines be drawn in the sand. And definitely Trump was kind of one of the first times we really started talking about it as a family. At least the kinds of different people in the family describing what kind of Republican they were, what kind of voter they were.
What happened with your family in terms of like this era?
A couple people became very like, I'm just going to say it. I'm voting for Trump and I'm into it. And then I would say 80% of the other people were like, let's do that and not talk about it. And then me and like three other cool cats were like, nope, bad. We're the left-wing people in the family. Bad, bad, bad. There were some blowups between me and family members, but a lot of that I'm going to actually say is on me. I mean, I was filled with left-wing anger when I saw Trump, especially coming from that Christian world, seeing someone so uncharitable, unscrupulous, somebody who didn't represent a single Christian value, sort of taking over my church. It ultimately underlined the fact that it wasn't my church anymore. Like it just ended up reaffirming my decisions to leave and leave it to them. So it was a good thing. I mean, overall, I think it will turn out to have been a good thing. Nobody likes to throw up, but your body wants to vomit for a reason. I think this was a 4 years of vomiting. And you know, it seems like we have ejected a considerable amount of poison. It also just highlighted a bunch of other stuff that's not going to go away. I think that was very valuable too. And eventually I made peace with those family members. I told them early on, I was like, you're going to regret this decision. You're going to regret this guy. He's going to blow it for you. And I think his presidency speaks for itself in that respect. And it also kind of taught me not to take leaders that seriously in general. Life's too short. And we have to be kind to each other on our own. I mean, that is something that we have to do as a society. I don't know. It's good now. I think it's good now. Everybody's good now. I don't know. I don't know. It was uncomfortable there for a minute. I you know what's interesting is they hated the Trump voice the first few years. They thought it was very disrespectful and it made everyone really queasy. By the end of the presidency, they were asking me to do it. Like this past Christmas, they were asking me to do Trump anytime we were all together. The same funny people that were the most vocally supportive of him. To me, I would sum that up as ultimately lost a ton of respect for him over the course of his decisions and behaviors and policies. That's what I thought would happen. And I'm glad that I could do my disrespectful voice and speak truth to power in whatever minuscule way it is. I don't care about changing anybody's minds about Trump. I only care about releasing the valve. What you were kind of talking about, like what's the duty of a comedian? Should we talk about politics or should we not? Ultimately, we just got to be true to ourselves, right? And if we're more political than we were a few years ago and we're being authentic, comedy should come out of that. If we're being inauthentic, being preachy, didactic, pedantic, comedy starts to be obscured by, I think, by that, by putting on a front. But if we're speaking from the heart and being ourselves, that should connect with audiences. I think that's what I found with Trump was being authentic. I thought he was ridiculous. But when I just started playing him as ridiculous instead of someone I hated, it became really fun for me and for audiences, I think.
Well put. Well, James, what are you up to? The comedians I know right now, I mean, same a lot with the musicians and whatnot, that it's a very tough time. Obviously they can't work. At least in the same way. I mean, you've figured out a way of getting out there and now Donald Trump has taken that away from you in some respect. Although, I certainly would have you come on the show and do Donald Trump probably for the next 10 to 15 years. I mean, based upon how long I hung on to Senator Catherine Harris, who was Secretary of State in the 2001 Florida election. But, what are you doing? What can people, if people want to check out more of your stuff, what would they do?
Right. Well, I think there's going to be a hunger for hearing Trump scream about Sonic the Hedgehog for many years to come. I think he will always be in our hearts and a source of aggravation that needs to be massaged. But if you want to watch the other comedy that I do, I have been a comedian for a lot longer than Trump has been president, and I do other comedy. Please find me at Shrimp, J-A-J, Shrimp, like my favorite protein. Shrimp, J-A-J, Shrimp Jaj on Twitter and Instagram. That's where I do a lot
Shrimp
of it.
Shrimp Jaj, right.
Shrimp Jaj. And you know what? The comedians right now, we're just preparing for that big Joe boom that he barely deserves. I mean, we're going to worship that guy once everything explodes and opens up and Hollywood starts spending money on performers like me again. I'm going to be so happy. And whoever's in charge during that is going to get a big garland parade. We're going to lift him up high on a chair. That's what I am looking forward to, is whatever sort of cultural pep is reintroduced as things even out and we can, you know, enjoy going to the grocery. I used to like going to the grocery store. I'm really looking forward to that.
James Austin Johnson, thanks so much, Dan. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you, Brandon. You're a wonderful person, and Judy and all of them, you know, at Chelsea and Richard. Wonderful, wonderful people.
I have no idea.
Great Americans. America Report. Listen to America Report every Thursday at 9 p.m. Or you can just change it or whatever you want to do.
All right. Well, yeah. All right. Yeah. Thank you. All right. We'll see you later. In other words, like, yeah. There we go. Well.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want. But I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bar. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot choice was made for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. The months shifted into years while I shifted in.